In Deuteronomy 13, Moses continues to exhort the Israelites about what to do once they conquer and settle down in the promised land. In chapter 12, he highlighted the importance of proper worship. And then in chapter 13, Moses highlights the importance of remaining loyal to God, even under challenging circumstances. Even when others attempt to lead you astray, he says, remain loyal, remain committed to God. He mentions three potential scenarios here, each one beginning with the word if. If this happens, here's what to do. If this happens, here's what to do. If this happens, here's what to do. Here's how to respond to these challenges or these potential problems. Chapter 12 dealt primarily with what happens when the Canaanites try to lead you astray. This would be an external threat. When they get into the land of Canaan, they are conquering these people. What to do about these false gods, this idolatrous religion that they'll find when they get into Canaan? That was chapter 12. Chapter 13 deals with what to do about their own people, challenges not external to them, but challenges internal within the nation of Israel. What are you going to do if the challenges are not coming from the Canaanite religion, but from your own people who are trying to lead you astray? So notice chapter 13, verse 1, if there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams. And likewise, he says the same thing two or three times here, among you, if this happens from your own people. So it's not so much the Canaanites now that are in view as the challenge. Now what about your own people from within your own nation? And in each one of these cases, someone from Israel might come along and say this. Notice verse 2 and verse 6 and verse 13. Let us go after other gods. So this is not a minor challenge here. This is not just some theological controversy. This is, let's leave the God of Israel and go after these other gods, these Canaanite gods or somebody else. But let's revoke or reject God, the true and living God, and let's go after these false gods. So the dangerous influence here comes from within Israel. Well, we live in a time of influence. People who have a following these days, particularly on the internet and on social media, what are they called? They're called influencers. Have you heard that expression before? There are people on social media who have millions of followers, and these people often make a very good income from being influencers. That is, companies pay them a lot of money to influence others, maybe to use their products and services, to advertise for them. I don't know how much these, you know, football players get for saying, I drive a Ford, or I drive a Chevy, or I use this this health thing, or I have this food that I use, or whatever. These people are making a lot of money. I wish someone would pay me to say, I drive a Chevy, or no, I drive a Rolls Royce, or I drive a, you know, Lincoln Continental or something. The idea is that we see on the internet and really all over the place, there are people who are influencing others, and oftentimes these influences are not good. They're not leading people in a good, solid way. But people follow influencers, and in our parlance, you might say, in our way of thinking, this is what Moses is warning Israel about now, is that the influences from within Israel may lead you astray. And so he says what to do if this happens. Moses' main point here is that our loyalty to God must exceed our loyalty to anyone else. This is the same thing that Jesus says in the New Testament. You have to love me more than father, mother, brother, sister. If you want to be my disciple, I have to come first. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. So we have to maintain loyalty. Whatever the person is, whatever the influence is that's anti-biblical, especially if they're trying to lead us astray theologically or spiritually, we have to maintain our loyalty to God and recognize that we're not about to follow these false influences in a bad way. So whether it's the Canaanites or the Israelites, whether it's a teacher, a relative, a friend, even a government official, we must maintain our allegiance to God and not follow anyone into apostasy. So let's look at the three scenarios here, these three cases of internal influence and what Moses says about maintaining our loyalty to God. So number one, first of all, religious or spiritual leaders must not divert us from loyalty to God. So notice verse 1, if there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder. So the first example, the first case here, would be a spiritual leader like a prophet, a dreamer of dreams. A prophet, of course, is simply someone who claims to speak for God. There are a lot of people today who claim to speak for God, and there were prophets at this time as well. In fact, Abraham is called a prophet. Moses is a prophet. So the idea of a prophet arising within Israel and saying, here's what God has said, thus saith the Lord, this was not an unusual thing. They could expect something like that to happen. He would arise from among you. So he's not a Canaanite, he's an Israelite. He's from the nation of Israel. And he's also maybe called a dreamer of dreams. A legitimate prophet might receive revelation of God through a dream. Of course, everybody dreams, but this is a person who gets his dreams from God. Numbers 12:6 says, if there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. So far, so good. This is all biblical. A prophet arises, he has a dream, and God speaks to him through that dream. That's fine. And then the prophet may be capable of a sign or a wonder. Notice in the end of verse 1, he gives you a sign or a wonder. This would be some sort of miraculous or unusual act, some deed that would be unusual, remarkable, that normally didn't happen, something that perhaps a prediction of what would happen or just a sign like a miracle. So he could possibly do that. And notice verse 2, the sign or the wonder comes to pass, which he spoke to you. So he makes a prediction and it happens. Or he does some sort of miraculous thing that turns out to be a true miracle. So this is not a trick. It's not a sleight of hand. It's not a nebulous thing that could happen to anybody. This is a genuine, or at least it looks like a genuine miracle that people should look at and say, okay, here's a person who claims to speak for God and he has a miracle that sort of backs that up. It validates the message. It validates that person as a true prophet. And that's what the signs and wonders were supposed to do. A prophet could give a prediction that came to pass. He could tell the future, you might say, or he could do a remarkable miracle, and that would validate him as a true spokesman for God, and then you would pay attention to his message. In this case, though, if a prophet does something, but going on in verse 2, it comes to pass, but he's saying, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. In this case, we have a dreamer of dreams or a prophet who does something, but he is a false teacher. Now, could it be the case that a prophet would be a false prophet who could do miracles? Well, we do have the example of the prophets, you might say, of Egypt under the leadership of Pharaoh. Remember when Moses went down to Pharaoh and said, let my people go. The false teachers, the false prophets of Egypt, were able to imitate or duplicate some of the miracles that Moses, the signs that Moses was given to do. So the fact that somebody could do miracles doesn't necessarily mean that his message is validated, okay? So miracles are not a valid criteria for determining truth. The fact that somebody could do a pretty neat trick doesn't necessarily mean that his message is true. So we have to evaluate not only the miraculous deed or the sign and wonder, but the message. We have to pay particular attention to the content of this person's message. We do not follow somebody just because he can do some impressive tricks. We always have to check the message of the speaker. So the fact that a speaker is impressive in various ways doesn't mean that he's true. We still see that today. That, I think, is a timeless principle that just because a person may be impressive in what he's able to do, maybe he's able to do some remarkable things, but that doesn't necessarily validate his message. Because there are people who are very compelling. They can speak very profoundly. They can do wonderful, remarkable things, but it doesn't necessarily validate their message. We always have to check the message itself. We always have to check the content of what the person is saying. And if what the person is saying is anti-Christ or anti-Bible, if it is contradictory to what the Bible says, well, then it doesn't matter if he can do signs and wonders. We always have to check what he's saying against the standard of God's word. So that's the problem. Notice again, verse 2, let us go after other gods. Although he's capable of miracles and remarkable deeds, his message contradicts what God has said. So that makes him a false prophet. And so Moses is encouraging the people to be discerning about that. Okay, let's say a prophet arises who can do these signs and wonders. He can do perhaps miraculous activities, but still, if his message, if his what he's speaking is not consistent with what God has already said, if he's trying to lead people astray, then you must not believe what he says. You must not follow him. This prophet is a false prophet because his message contradicts what God has already revealed. The prophet is promoting rebellion against God, and so he is a false prophet. Well, today we have to be very discerning still, because there are many false prophets among us. There are false prophets that are within, hopefully not this church, but in the wider church, there are people who lead others astray. You know, Jesus warned us repeatedly about false prophets who would arise. Paul even said, "From among you will arise false prophets preaching ungodly things." He told that to the Ephesian elders there in Acts. And so we have to recognize that we are potentially influenced by people who would lead us astray as well. There are many modern influencers that promote a message that is simply unbiblical or in error. In fact, yesterday as I was doing some things around the house, minding my own business, lo and behold, a couple people pulled up in a van and they tried to influence me away from God. The guy got out of the van, very nice gentleman, and he was holding a Bible and he had a little brochure he wanted to give me. He wanted to invite me to the program that they were doing. And we had a nice exchange for 10 or 15 minutes as he tried to lead me astray. And I tried to show him that he was wrong. And he was very adamant in his position. I don't think I made any headway with him, because for every argument that I had, he had a counter argument. I tried to persuade him that he was wrong, and he tried to persuade me that I was wrong. But he was an influencer. And fortunately, I had a little bit of background and a little bit of training in the very things that he was promoting, and I was not led astray, I don't think, by him. But, you know, he was, after dealing with me, I'm sure that he went down the street and tried to reach other people. And I think that there would probably be others that would not know. They don't know about some of the things that he was saying to the degree that they could defend themselves against his allegations or claims. So there are prophets out there, false prophets, there are influences out there, there are people out there intentionally leading others astray. And I told this guy, that's what you are doing. You are trying to lead me astray. You are a false prophet. You are wrong in what you are alleging. Your claims are false. And even though he tried to defend them, I'm certain that what he was saying was false. And they, you know, this is a Jehovah's Witness guy, as you probably surmised, and they're leading people astray. So we need to be discerning enough to see. And you could look at this guy and say, he's a good gentleman, a nice guy, he's holding the Bible. What can be wrong with that? Well, there's plenty wrong with that if you are discerning enough. If you know the truth, well, then when error crops up, you should be able to see that it's error. So what do we do then in this case? Notice going on to verse 3, "You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams." So the first thing is, don't listen. You should know enough to understand that his message is wrong. Don't listen to it. Don't enter into ecumenical dialogue. Don't welcome him into your home. Don't go alongside in cooperative ministry with that person. No, you don't listen to that. You recognize that God is testing you, verse 2 or verse 3 there in the middle. "For the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." Will you remain faithful to God when you're challenged by some ungodly, unbiblical message? Or are you going to be led astray when the Jehovah's Witnesses come knocking at your door? "Oh, you're telling me the Bible. You're right on this. I hadn't ever considered this before. Maybe you have the answers." Well, you're being led astray. Will you remain faithful to the Lord under that kind of challenge? Will you believe a false teacher or remain loyal to what God has already taught? So this is a test of faithfulness, a test of commitment. Will you remain committed under the challenging circumstances like that? And then verse 4, "Continue in service." Continue your commitment. "You shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him. Keep his commandments. Obey his voice. You shall serve him and hold fast to him." So that's the idea of retaining your commitment. Even under the pressure of false prophets, somebody bringing you a challenging message, something that you've never maybe heard before, or some odd interpretation of Scripture, No, you don't listen to that. You don't follow that. You continue to serve the Lord your God. You retain your wholehearted commitment to the Lord. And beyond that, a very drastic response here, verse 5. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he spoken in order to turn you away from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Put that person to death. This false prophet is guilty of sedition or promoting rebellion against God. He's worthy of death. That is the appropriate penalty for such a person at that time and in that place. Putting such a person to death is how you put away evil from your midst. Remember, this guy is rising up from among you. How to put away that evil, get rid of it? Well, in this case, he was worthy of death. The word put away literally means to burn or consume. I don't think he's going to be talking about stoning that person with stones, so he's not talking about burning that person to death. But the idea is consuming that person, eradicating that person, like burning it down to the ground so there's nothing left of it. It has no more influence. And so you eradicate that threat. Well, do we have false prophets and dreamers of dreams today who are trying to lead us astray? Yes, there are. Jesus warns us about that. We see that all around us. Some of them are actively trying to deconvert Christians. I don't know if you see that, if you have any evidence of that in your life, if you know people like that, people who are trying to argue Christians out of Christianity. They provide arguments or they try to present ideas that try to deconvert Christians. That's what they want to do. Or maybe like the Muslims are trying to get Christians to worship their God. I don't know if the Hindus and the others are trying to cause Christians or try to gain a following among Christians to move them to worship other gods. But either they're trying to get Christians to deconvert or to worship another god, or I suppose atheists are out there trying to undercut the basis of Christianity and get people to doubt Christianity. There's lots of that going on. So how do we respond to that? When somebody comes, the Jehovah's Witness comes knocking at your door, do you pull out your gun and shoot him in the forehead? Well, no, we don't kill. We don't stone people like that. Sometimes we might, you know, be very mad about this, but we don't kill people. What do we do, though, is that we kill the false doctrine. We kill the false prophecy. We kill the false arguments in a certain way. We don't kill people. We kill the theological error. I don't know how effective I was when I was speaking to that JW guy yesterday, but that was my intent, to kill his false doctrine, to show him the error of his ways. Sometimes when people are faced by that, they say, no thanks, I have my own religion, you know, I'm whatever, and I don't want to talk to you, thanks, goodbye. And that is an appropriate response in some cases. But in other cases, I think we want to challenge that false theology, and we want to show them the error of their ways. That's what I was trying to do yesterday with a gentleman. And so we want to attack in a certain way. We want to kill, not the individual, but the bad ideas. We want to show him the error of his ways. And so we want to tear down, as it were, to consume or burn up that falsehood. Now, oftentimes we're not so effective at that or maybe successful doing that, but that should be our intent. And we have very good ammunition for this battle. The facts are on our side, especially when the atheists or the evolutionists coming against Christianity. We have the facts on our side. They can't explain reality nearly as well as we can explain reality. The facts of Christianity are historical. We can prove beyond shadow of a doubt, or at least historically, in that historical orientation, there's very good evidence, for example, that Jesus died on the cross and rose again. These are the basics of the faith that we can prove. There's archaeology, there's history, there's many things, manuscript evidence on the side of Christianity to show that it's true. So we have substance. We can substantiate our faith. We don't have to be afraid of the evolutionists. We don't have to be afraid of the atheists. We don't have to be afraid of the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormons, because we have the truth on our side. And so sometimes we can show the error of their way. But another thing we have to do, not only try to kill the false prophecy, but also at the end of verse 5, he says, so you shall put the evil away. Put away the evil from your midst. Put away the evil. If the false teaching is showing up in the midst of us, remember this is in the midst of Israel, if the false teaching is showing up from the middle of the church or from within the church, Well, we have to confront it. We have to deal with it. We have to expose it. Perhaps we have to discipline someone. We have to put the false prophet out of the church. We don't just coexist with such a person. We don't just allow that false prophecy, false teaching to continue on and have a bad influence on the church. We have to get rid of such a person. Of course, we don't kill anybody, but we must take decisive action sometimes, sometimes very stern action, sometimes very severe action. If we have a false teacher arising from the middle of the church, we don't just put up with that. We would have to address it very sternly and very severely. We must guard and maintain the purity of the church, and that requires that we put away the evil. So when a false prophet arises to influence us away from God, what do? We remain loyal to the Lord. Verse 4, walk after him, fear him, keep his commands, obey his voice, serve him, hold fast to him. Don't give up the faith. And I don't know, there may be people here today who are under the influence of maybe an atheist, under the influence of some evolutionist, under the influence of some critic or skeptic of the faith, and they show all these things about why you can't believe that Christianity is true. And you may be thinking, boy, I've never heard that before. I guess I was misled. Well, for all these arguments that the atheists and the evolutionists bring forth, Christians have been responding to those things for close to 2,000 years. There's very good reasons to believe what we believe. I can show you books and articles and studies and lessons and things about how we respond to some of these attacks against Christianity. And so we don't need to give up the faith. We have very good reason for believing what we believe, and we need to remain loyal to the Lord and committed to the ways that he has taught us. So those are the false prophets arising from among you. Secondly, the second case, the second scenario here is in verses 6 through 11. Personal relationships must not divert us from loyalty to God. So the first one is the false prophet. And, you know, listening to the false prophet, you could listen or not. That's kind of outside your family, outside your personal space. But this is much more difficult now. This is your family member. This is a loved one. This is a friend, as he says here, verse 6. If your brother, the son of your mother, so this is your blood brother, your son or your daughter, the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is as your own soul. Okay, so all these things, all these people have what in common? Love. These are people you love. These are your loved ones. Family, close personal friends. So this would be the threat is from among your own family and friends. Personal relationships. So in this case, the person from your own family, a close personal friend, is trying to lead you astray. So notice what they say here. The friend of your as of your own soul secretly entices you, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers. Okay, so somebody from your own family, your own personal friends come along and they entice you to go after other gods. Now the issue here really is, again, influence. What's a stronger influence? The false prophet who, you know, you see down at the synagogue, or you see at church, or you see him out in the world, the false prophet, or the personal friend, or your spouse, your father, your mother, your cousin, a very close personal friend, a person who has ties of love and emotion. Well, these people have a huge influence on us. And notice what they're doing. They're doing this secretly, verse 6 again. He comes secretly. He secretly entices you. So this is something done privately. There's the public aspect of the false teacher. He's speaking out to everybody. But this is in private. He comes over to your house, or you may be at his house. This is just the two of you talking at a restaurant. So this is a private relationship, and these individual private relationships can be very strong, very persuasive. Many people end up coming to Christ because of a private relationship. That is, a friend, a loved one, invites someone to church or gives them the gospel, and people are saved because of private relationships. This is a private relationship where people are not encouraging you to come to Christ or stay loyal to God. This is a private relationship where they're encouraging you to go after other gods, okay? And so how do you respond to this? Well, it'd be easy just to do nothing. It'd be easy to keep this a secret, especially if the individual says, now, don't tell anybody else, but I think we ought to leave God and go serve Baal. There's this god called Molech. He's really great. and we ought to go serve him because he can provide a whole lot more than the God of Israel provides. But don't tell anybody, okay? Well, it'd be easy to keep a secret because this is done in secret. This is done privately. Nobody else maybe knows about it. And because of the relationship of love, you want to protect that other person. You know that what he's saying is wrong, but he's my buddy, he's my friend, he's my brother, he's my father, she's my mother, she's my spouse. So I don't want anything bad to happen to this loved one. So I don't have to say anything about this. I can just be quiet. Okay, mum's the word. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to expose you. I'm going to keep your secret because of our bonds of love. Well, that'd be an easy response. But we can't do that. Notice verse 8. You shall not consent to him or listen to him, nor shall your eye pity him, nor shall you spare him or conceal him. So the response to this has to be the same. It has to be exposure. It has to be telling what happened. Do not consent. Proverbs 1:10, if sinners entice you, do not consent. So the influence that we get from this loved one, this fellow family member, this relative, they're highly influential, and yet we do not consent to them. And we do not spare or conceal. We must expose it. If they're promoting idolatry, we cannot keep that a secret. The temptation would be, I don't want to get this person into trouble, so I'm not going to say anything. But we can't do that. We have to expose it. And another very extreme result here is in verse 10. You shall stone him with stones. Well, verse 9, you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. You shall stone him with stones until he dies, because he sought to entice you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Now, this would be a terrible thing to have to do. Could you imagine if your wife or your daughter, your son, your loved one, your very best friend comes along and does something like this? I don't know that there's any example, maybe one example in the Bible, but really we don't find this happening very often. But imagine if something like this would happen. This is a radical step to take, to kill a family member or a good friend. The nature of this error is so serious that the only solution is the death of the influencer. Somebody put it this way: one person is stoned to death to save the whole community from being drawn away from the Lord. Sin which is not purged will end in devastation for the whole community. The seriousness of this punishment fits the seriousness of the crime, a bold-faced act of rebellion against God. So we have to see the true nature of this. We have to see that this is sedition. This is rebellion against God. This is not just a minor theological controversy. This is the advocacy, the promotion of idolatry. And if there's one thing that God hates, well, there are many things, but high on the list of God, the things that God hates is idolatry. And so for somebody to be promoting and advocating for idolatry is absolutely against everything that God stands for. So the person has to have the fortitude, verse 9, your hand shall be first against him. What did Jesus say with the woman caught in adultery? He who is without sin, throw the first stone. Well, here, throw the first stone. If you know about this, you know about this idolatrous enticement, you're the one that this person spoke to, you have to throw the first stone. And so this is a radical step. It'd be very difficult to do, but this is what the Lord calls for. This drastic action would be a deterrent, going on to verse 11. So all Israel shall hear and fear and not again do such wickedness as this among you. And again, notice the emphasis on among you. This is dealing with sin in the camp, sin in the nation of Israel. Israel must not tolerate this kind of idolatrous influence, because if that starts spreading, well, pretty soon Israel is going to be idolatrous. They're no longer going to be following the Lord. They must destroy idolatry before it destroys the nation. So they simply will not tolerate idolatry. Now, I wish they would have followed this, but as we go along, you start reading in Joshua and especially in Judges, they did not follow this kind of principle. They got into idolatry very quickly, but they shouldn't have. Well, what about us today? Again, we're not talking about stoning anybody with stones, but we have to recognize here the case in which the relatives or the friends have a bad influence on your family. Now, some of us may be a little bit naive in thinking that family and friends would never have a bad influence on our family. Family and friends never do that kind of thing. I have no concern with family and friends coming into my house or doing anything negative to my family or exposing my children to anything negative. I could send my children over to so-and-so's house and I wouldn't have to worry about them seeing any movies or hearing any, you know, music or seeing any images. I wouldn't have to worry about any of that. That is absolutely naive. In other words, that kind of terrible thing, the exposure to bad ideas from family and friends, happens all the time, much more than you would expect. And the people who bring in wickedness to your own home may be people of your own family. It may be family friends. The people who abuse and are guilty of heinous sins could be people of your own family and people who are part of your household, people who are your family friends. And so this is why you have to be exceedingly careful about who the kind of influence you allow, even from family and friends. That's where especially the man of the house, the father, the husband, has to be the gatekeeper in certain ways. Well, both husband and wife have to work together to make sure to avoid these negative influences. Now, this is, of course, in a theological way, trying to draw the people away from God. I'm speaking in a little bit more broader context here, that there may be influences that you would not want in your home, and there may be things, obviously, that you would not want anybody to do, people doing things or saying things or exposing your family to things. And you might be very surprised that a family member would do that, but don't be surprised because it happens all the time. So we have to be very careful about that. I wonder how many people have left the faith under the influence of a relative, a friend, or a spouse. I wonder how many times family members lead other Christians astray. Again, sadly, theologically speaking, that happens. The point here is that our loyalty to God must supersede that of family or friends. Loyalty to God must trump any other kind of loyalty, even if it's a loved one. So we have to follow the Lord no matter what. Commitment to God may cost us certain relationships. We cannot retain a relationship with a person if he's trying to lead us astray. If the influence of that relative or friend is destructive to my spiritual well-being, then I may have to break off that relationship. Remember what Jesus said, "He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." You cannot be my disciple unless, Jesus said, unless you follow him first and foremost. And so there may be times when we have to make a very difficult decision in saying, sorry, family or friend, sorry, loved one, you can't be here. We can't have a relationship with you because of your horrible influence on our family or because of what you've done in the past or because of our concern. We're not going to send little Johnny or Susie over to your house to spend the night because we are concerned about that. We are concerned about the kind of exposure that they're going to get or the potential of abusive situations. We're not going to allow that. And so families have to be very critically concerned about these influences. We should also let our children know that if someone does something to them and tells them to keep it a secret, they're not obligated to keep that secret. And again, I'm not going to get into graphic descriptions here, but I think most of us adults recognize that in some cases, there are predators who do terrible, heinous things to young children and tell them to keep it a secret and maybe make threats against them. And the child is innocent enough and doesn't know enough to know that they can report that to their parents. They should report that to their parents or their legal guardian or whoever it is, even law enforcement. Sometimes little children are told that they have to keep certain things secret and they can't tell anybody else under threat of some sort. Well, that's where parents have to educate their children, and I'm trying to do a little bit of that right now, is educating people to know that if something terrible like that happens to you and somebody says, oh, you know, I'm your friend, I'm your family member. Don't tell anybody, don't tell your mom or your daddy, because various things might happen, you know, certain things, terrible things could happen if you report this. And the little child doesn't know enough to know that he doesn't have to keep that secret. He should not keep that secret. He should report that happens. So this is an example of the private situation where somebody tells or somebody does, somebody exposes the individual to a terrible thing, and the potential, the temptation is to keep it a secret and not expose it. Well, we absolutely cannot do that. We see that swift and severe punishment is the proper result of this kind of thing happening. Swift and strict punishment is a deterrent to further crime. That's one of the reasons that we see injustice in our justice system today, is that there's not swift and immediate punishment of this kind of behavior. And so we need to do that, I think, as a society. And even in the church, it may be necessary for swift and stern punishment. Let's say if we talked about a false prophet arising, or if some abusive situation should occur. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are churches that have dealt with abusive situations arising from within the church, and sometimes the church just covers it up, sweeps it under the rug. Well, we absolutely cannot do that. If any kind of abusive situation would arise within the church, we have to deal with it, we have to be stern, we have to be strong about it, and we're not going to kill the person, but we are going to deal with it very sternly or strongly. Two, as it says here, purge the evil. Sometimes that's exactly what we have to do, to purge the evil from the church. 1 Timothy 5:20, them that sin rebuke before all, that others also may fear. Same idea, deterrent. The deterrent, once you rebuke the individual, this is a private sin, but it becomes a public matter, a matter of public knowledge. And sometimes you have to bring that up before the church and rebuke it sternly so that others may fear. And so Moses has addressed two of these cases. This would be apostasy that is promoted by false prophets and apostasy promoted by private friends and family members. He's got one more category, and that is verses 12 and following. If you hear someone in your cities, which the Lord your God gives you to dwell in, okay, this is when you're in the promised land, and you hear this report, verse 13, corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known. Okay, so this case is that public officials, it's not entirely certain who these people are, but I take it that these are influential people within a community. I would call them public officials, or maybe just fellow citizens. They must not divert us from loyalty to God. Notice at the beginning of 13, corrupt men. This is the sons of Belial. That's what that expression means. Sons of Belial are corrupt men. These are worthless men, wicked, destructive, deceitful people who lead others astray. And once again, from among you. This is not the Canaanites or the Jebusites. These are Israelites from among the cities that they've conquered. And that they are enticing you, verse 13 again, they've enticed the inhabitants of the city. Enticing here, the sense of compel or force or drive, thrust. So they've pushed this idea. They've pushed this idea of let us go and seek other gods. They've promoted this idea. They've tried to force the people into this. They're promoting idolatry. And the sense is that the entire city has been paganized. Apostasy has gripped the whole town under the influence of wicked men. Well, what do we do? Well, verse 14, then you shall inquire, search out, and ask diligently, and if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall certainly strike the inhabitants of the city with the edge of the sword. So the first thing is to do to check it out. Make an inquiry, search, ask. Do this diligently. Due diligence to check to see if this actually happened. Take care to find out the facts of the case. Inquire, probe into it, search it, examine it. And if you find that that abomination was committed, well, then you have to do some pretty radical response to that. This word abomination in verse 14, You shall inquire and search out and seek diligently if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you. Okay, abomination is a disgusting thing. Something utterly wicked, something unclean, something detestable. Pushing others, influencing others, promoting idolatry is detestable. It is an abomination. Well, if that has happened, you're sure that it's happened, you've inquired into it, and it's a fact, well, verse 15, strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, and all that is in it and its livestock with the edge of the sword. Strike the city, you destroy it. The assumption is that the entire city now has become idolatrous. They followed these sons of Belial, these public officials. The people of the city had followed their leaders into idolatry, and the whole town now is responsible for the rebellion against God. And remember that this is one of the cities of the Israelites. These are Jews. They knew the covenant. They knew the responsibility that they had to remain loyal and faithful to God. They knew the consequences of following other gods. So they are responsible here because they followed the sons of Belial rather than following God. So strike it with the edge of the sword, verse 16. Gather all its plunder in the middle of the street. Completely burn the city with fire and its plunder for the Lord your God. Notice it's on his behalf. This is something that is dedicated to destruction for God. You are dedicating it to God by destroying it. That's what the word harem means here. Something under the ban, something destroyed. The accursed thing, verse 17. None of the accursed things, that's the harem material, the things that are to be destroyed. None of that shall remain in your hand, that the Lord your God may turn from the fierceness of his anger and show you mercy, have compassion on you and multiply you just as he swore to your fathers. So the city now becomes an accursed thing that is devoted to destruction, and you're doing that for the Lord. Just like one of the Canaanite cities. Remember, the same idea was true of the Canaanite idolaters. They were to be destroyed for the Lord. Somebody said, clearly, those who rebel against the Lord by breaking the covenant and going after other gods are no better than the heathen and deserve the same punishment. Their doom indicates how serious the Lord considered defection from him. So put the city to the sword, burn it to the ground, don't even rebuild it. And then verse 18, remain loyal to God. Verse 18, because you've listened to the voice of the Lord your God, keep all his commandments, which I command you today, to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord your God. So instead of following these sons of Belial, these worthless men, into idolatry, destroy that city, kill all those people, burn it to the ground, don't rebuild it, and remember to be loyal to the Lord. I wonder if we have worthless men among our public officials today. Are there sons of Belial among our politicians? I'd say about half of them, maybe three quarters of them, are sons of Belial. Oftentimes they're leading people astray. These are people who ought to be doing the very opposite. They ought to be encouraging us to be loyal to God. They ought to be encouraging us to be virtuous. They ought to be encouraging us to do the right thing, but instead they're doing the opposite. We have public officials who defend and promote the things that God hates. Obviously, we're not killing people. We don't destroy their cities. We don't burn things down. You know, there are people in our world who do burn cities down. If you've been paying attention to the news over the last couple of years, there have been violent riots in which people burn things to the ground, almost, you know, large parts of cities. Are we encouraging that? Are we advocating and promoting going into a city and burning the place down? No, we're not involved with that. People like us don't do that kind of thing. Christians are not responsible for that. Political conservatives don't participate in those violent, deadly riots. Worthless people, sons of Belial, do that kind of thing. In our situation, what do we do with public officials who lead the public astray? Well, we are fortunate that we can vote the bums out of office every 2 or 4 or 6 years. We vote people in and out of office. We can throw them out. And, you know, in certain cities, we can move away from those places. You know, there's a flight. People are kind of what they call self-sorting these days. They're leaving those places that are poorly managed, poorly governed. places like California. People are leaving California and moving to places like Florida and Texas if they want to stay in the South, because they recognize that these are places where they allow the criminals to be in charge of the penitentiary. They're allowing the fox to be in charge of the hen house. They're allowing these sons of Belial to be in charge of the whole place. And what you get is chaos and terrible violence. So we don't do that. In some cases, we might take more radical steps to get rid of public officials who are sons of Belial, people who need to be impeached, people who need to be recalled, people who maybe need lawsuits done against them. So we know how to deal with these public officials or cities that are leading others astray. So how do you respond under the kind of influence that would lead you into idolatry? Under challenging circumstances where people are trying to lead you astray, what do you do when the Jehovah's Witness comes knocking at your door and is attempting to lead you astray? Will you remain loyal or will you compromise? You know, it's possible, as I was thinking about this, it's possible, it's a very sad thing for me to think about, that over the years of my ministry, I've seen people just like this sitting in pews, or like when I was a youth pastor, coming to the youth activities regularly, faithfully with their friends and family. And 5 years goes by and they're gone. They're no longer serving the Lord. They're no longer going to church. They may not even retain the name of Christian. They're gone. And these are people who maybe professed faith, maybe even showed some evidence of salvation. And yet some influence came, something happened where they're no longer serving the Lord. Maybe they're no longer claiming to be a Baptist or a conservative Christian or an evangelical Christian or not even a Christian at all. They've gone elsewhere. Maybe they're not serving God. Maybe they're bowing down to idols, for all I know. But they're no longer serving the Lord. People that you would think that would never happen. These people would never compromise. These people would never leave the Lord. And yet they did. I can give you several examples, a number of examples. Even people that I baptized here, right there, I baptized these people. And now where are they? Nowhere to be found. Not serving the Lord. Not even claiming to be Christians. What happened to them? Some influence, maybe a spouse, maybe a family member, maybe a false prophet, maybe a corrupt government official, I don't know, but somebody came along with a bad influence to lead them astray. They did not retain their commitment to God. And all of us are going to be faced with some challenges to our faith. So what are we going to do? Are we just going to capitulate, give in, cave in to this kind of thing? Or will we remain faithful and loyal? This passage is a warning to us to be careful about the influences we allow in our lives. Will you retain these relationships, if you have them, with these sons of Belial, these worthless people who are leading you astray? Will you continue to follow false prophets and erroneous spiritual leaders? Will you vote for corrupt public officials? Well, I certainly hope not. The correct response to anti-God influences is to exclude them from your life. As he says at the very beginning, do not listen, verse 3, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet. And likewise with the private individual, the friend, the family member, do not listen to that person. The public official who is trying to lead you astray, do not listen to them. Do not consent. Do not allow access to them. Do not allow them to be an influence. And if you want to be more proactive, fight against them. You don't just say, okay, Mr. J.W., great to see you today. Hope I'll, you know, God bless as you go along to try to mislead somebody else. No, you fight against them. You argue against them. You demonstrate the error of their way. Of course, we're not talking about destroying anybody physically or doing any harm, but we can destroy their arguments and seek to undermine their bad ideas. We can try to degrade and reduce their influence. And if nothing else, we can just keep them at arm's length. Keep them away from us. Keep them away from our family so that they're not going to have a bad influence. So what should be our response? Verse 18. Listen to the voice of the Lord your God. Keep his commandments, which he commands you. Do what is right in the eyes of the Lord your God. There's the solution. There's how you deal with anybody who would try to lead you astray. Listen to God. Obey his commandments. Do what is right. That's how you succeed in the Christian life. That's a recipe for success and commitment and loyalty to God. Well, let's close in prayer.